Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, there's been a rise in challenges to books in schools and public libraries. Why is it happening and what's the impact? Also, we'll talk with a group of teenagers who consider themselves peace warriors. They're living in a community where gun violence is all too common. We'll find out how the newest military branch measures physical fitness. Also, being a farmer can be a difficult job. The pandemic made things harder, and many say it affected their mental health. We'll learn about outreach programs to help those in need. People dealing with addiction are often leery of healthcare providers. That's even more of a problem when the addict is pregnant. That story's on the way. And we'll visit with a spoken word poet. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, people who are pregnant and struggling with addiction worry about many things, including mistreatment from healthcare providers. We'll look at efforts to remove barriers to addiction treatment and prenatal care. More farmers are struggling with mental health issues. What's being done to address that problem? And we'll look at the rise in challenges to certain books in schools and public libraries. Those stories and more coming up this hour. A group of Chicago teenagers spent the past few months learning about the nonviolent strategies of Martin Luther King Jr. The goal? To create peace warriors who make their high school and community safer. But on Chicago's west side, which has been rocked by gun violence, can the message get through? Sarah Karp brings us that story.
Over the summer, a group of west side teenagers went on a journey. They learned the strategies of nonviolence, and then they went out and taught others. In community centers, churches, and schools, almost everywhere, they first had to confront the reality of what they and their peers are experiencing.
I see the blood marks, and I see he's just all bloody. His shoes, everything on him was bloody.
2018, he killed himself because people judged him for the way he looked, the way he acted. And when you see it, you're in shock.
Because everybody just started dying 2 weeks apart, so I just lost another friend, got shot on the bus, so I've been in my little moods lately.
It was just horrible because they actually did end up coming up to the school once we left. Like, they literally shot at the school once we left, and we were just wondering, like, what if that would have been one of us?
The students from North Ondo College Prep have been trained to listen to and to participate in conversations where these stories come up. They respond by presenting the principles of nonviolence.
The first principle is nonviolence is the way of life for courageous people.
These are the principles that Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's associates developed after he directed them, just before his death, to operationalize nonviolence. To become peace warriors themselves, these teens learned these principles inside and out.
Develop.
Community.
Is the framework
for the future.
They have two tasks. Teach these ideals to others in the community and keep peace in their school. Gerald Smith is a restorative justice specialist at the Westside Charter School. He says the school launched its peace warrior work in 2009 in desperation.
There were all kinds of gang factions, all kinds of other things that were created. We had about 100 fights that year.
A former teacher came upon Kingian nonviolence education. One of King's associates, Dr. Bernard Lafayette, came to North Lawndale College Prep to get it underway.
And he says, I see that this school on the west side of Chicago can become not only a haven, but a launching pad for students and people embracing and living nonviolence and creating all kinds of necessary positive change.
Smith is also a pastor with a booming voice, a poetic cadence, and a strong belief that change really is possible. And he believes that the peace warriors play a crucial role. They prevent fights, break them up, and run peace circles. The school's administration credits them with reducing fighting, and they offer hugs and candy to students confronting tragedy. But there's so much of it. Smith tracked students who lost someone, and it was often more than 150 by year's end. And in the face of this, teaching about nonviolence doesn't suddenly make these teenagers believers. Here's how one put it during a discussion this summer.
The system, the juvenile system, the county, just the ops. I feel like me personally, I can't be a peaceful person because you got to worry about, you constantly got to look over your shoulder for whatever.
Ops is a term used to describe an enemy. Using nonviolence to confront a systemic injustice is one thing, but it's harder when it affects your brother, cousin, friend. Here's what another young man said in response to the question of nonviolence.
The challenges of being a peaceful person is the stuff you've been through, or like the stuff you see as a child. So like, say you see someone get killed, you ain't gonna be a peaceful person no more.
One of the hardest principles for the teenagers to make sense of is number six.
The universe is on the side of justice. Repeat after me. The universe is on the side.
Though Deanna introduced the principle with enthusiasm, she revealed she doubted it. She's one of the teenagers who was trained as a peace warrior this summer. Deanna has a cherub face and wears her hair in a puff. She's usually on the quieter side. But then she told the story of her cousin who got shot outside her aunt's house.
And the police came and they said that he was in a foot chase. And so they chased him and they shot him in the back of his head. And the only thing he had in his pocket was a speaker. And they shot and killed my cousin and said it was suicide.
Deanna says she doesn't think there'll ever be justice for her cousin. And what should the response be?
Violence. It made me angry.
At the end of the summer, Deanna said she still felt the same way, but others felt changed. A teen named Tyrika had just seen her cousin get shot and killed, and she said the principals gave her a different way to react. Some said the experience made them hopeful, like Jaquan. He said one principal stood out to him as a beacon in the face of the violence in his community.
Principle number two, the beloved community is the framework for the future. I just believe if we put in the work and start to, you know, push people to do their best, what we get out is the results, and something good might come out of it.
Smith, the preacher, said teaching nonviolence is a long game. It's what King spoke about.
Right, and if we can hold on to the faith that one day all wrongs will be made right. The universe, the arc of the universe, is bent towards justice and right. It is bent towards light. So eventually darkness will be overcome by light.
That's why, even if the ground is hard and dry, he said it's still important to plant the seed.
Sarah Karp with that report. Years ago, DeKalb Public Schools unveiled a diversity plan. It was the culmination of years worth of work in an increasingly diverse district. The pandemic was a wrench in the plans, but it led DeKalb to hire its first ever director of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Peter Medlin reports.
15 years ago, when Amana Quinette Parker moved to DeKalb to be a teacher, her best friend was a little concerned for her.
I was told by my best friend, who was an educator in another city, girl, are you crazy? That's going to be hard being a black person in DeKalb.
It didn't stop her from moving and setting down roots for her family, and she's not alone. Every single year since 2008, the number of black students in DeKalb has gone up. The district now has twice as many black students as when she arrived. But it's something she's thought about since in every role she's been in. How can DeKalb be more welcoming and inclusive? She's been a teacher, welcoming new students of color, at times one of the only black teachers they may have. And she's been a principal, making sure new families feel comfortable and helping recruit fellow teachers of color to come to DeKalb like she did. And now she's leading these conversations as the district's first ever director of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Parker is the point person for equity initiatives outlined in the district's diversity plan. And some of the plan's goals are tangible, like increasing the number of teachers of color in the district. Others are a little more difficult to define, like strengthening district and school unity and collaboration. Now, some of these plans have been hindered by the pandemic, and others just haven't made much progress. For example, in the 4 years since the diversity plan launched, teacher demographics haven't changed much at all. But despite of a lack of a district-wide shift, Parker says it was a top priority for her as principal at Huntley Middle School. It was a legacy she wanted to leave that she wrote down in her first month on the job.
When I came to Huntley Middle School, there were three people, myself, the principal at that time, and then a counselor. That was it. When I was looking at some of the data just this past week, there are like 17 people of color in Huntley Middle School.
But she says the new job doesn't have her shut in an office every day, compiling data and building PowerPoints for professional development trainings. Her work touches every part of the district, and she gets to step out into the community. She's already had the chance. A recent community meeting hit home how crucial student voices are. There was a question about food waste at a breakfast program that could maybe be fixed by simply offering students water instead of milk or juice.
He said, and they're teaching us not to waste food, take care of our planet, to take care of our future, right? And then simply just like, well, what about water? Oh yeah, we would drink water. Why didn't we think of that?
She's also pulled in student perspectives to rewrite the student handbook.
We didn't just get the students who the teachers recommend. We got that kid who has been written up a lot of times. So it would be that kid that would be able to say, you know what? You gave me in-school suspension for that. It really didn't make a difference. And so I'm really proud of that.
Sometimes her work does mean analyzing data and getting into the nitty-gritty of student outcomes. The other day, she sat in on a meeting about sixth grade enrollment and if having too many students will force some of them to have to move to a different school.
Having conversations about the fairness to a family that we have welcomed brand new to our community, been here less than 3 weeks, and now we're saying we're going to have to overflow you, even though you've gotten in the car. Look at you guys' school. That's the school you're going to go to. And now we're having a conversation about, hey, we're kind of tight in that grade. Are we going to split your kids up? We're going to get together. All that piece lies in this position.
Parker says even though COVID did make reaching some goals more difficult, they have made significant steps with their diversity plan. For one, it was a key reason their second-year superintendent, Minerva Garcia Sanchez, chose DeKalb. She says they've also established a multilingual parent university program to empower Latino families. And even with success stories like Parent University, she says the work is never done. They recently heard that some Arabic-speaking families wanted to feel more included.
Not all schools send out all the information in Arabic. Even if it's just one family, its home language is Arabic, we should be communicating.
But sometimes the goals in diversity, equity, and inclusion aren't as straightforward as just include Arabic or hire more teachers of color. It's about making sure everyone in the district is on the same page when it comes to making students feel welcome.
I think a lot of times people hear the word diversity and equity and they go, oh, that scares me. What are you trying to say? You know, but really it's like doing the right thing.
Parker says it's a challenge in a community as culturally diverse as DeKalb, where urban meets rural, as she likes to say. But she says that diversity is a strength, and it makes her work all the more important. I'm Peter Medlin.
People who are pregnant and struggling with addiction can face many barriers to getting the health care they need. Many fear mistreatment from health care providers, and they worry they might lose custody of their baby. Side Effects Public Media's Darian Benson reports some clinics are looking at ways to better engage with and support these patients.
When Michelle Kavoris went into labor, she waited as long as she possibly could before going to the hospital.
Because I knew what was coming, I knew I wasn't going to be welcomed, given the situation that I was in.
Kavoris was actively using cocaine and made the decision to place her child for adoption. Her son was born with drugs in his system. She remembers the doctor screaming at her.
Telling me, how could I do this to my baby? I'm selfish. Things I already knew. Didn't need to hear from somebody shouting at me. And instead of like offering me any kind of help or anything, he just wanted to shame me and make me feel worse than I already did.
That was 13 years ago. And Kavora says she doesn't want anyone else to go through what she did. She's been in recovery for 6 years and now works at a health center on the west side of Chicago. Kavoris is a doula. That's someone who provides physical and emotional support to pregnant people before, during, and after childbirth. Doulas are non-medical professionals who help clients advocate for themselves in healthcare settings. Research shows having a doula can improve health outcomes for both moms and babies. But Kavoris is more than just a doula. She's also a certified peer recovery specialist, someone who is experienced with addiction who helps others on their recovery journey.
There's such a stigma that it prevents people from getting the health care that they deserve. I love to see when somebody is like, oh, wait, you guys are so nice to me. Why are you being so nice to me? And I get to tell them it's because you deserve it.
Kavoris's work is part of a pilot program Illinois launched in 2019 to provide peer recovery doulas to pregnant people with substance use disorders. Dr. Ruchi Fitzgerald helps lead that program. She's a family physician and addiction medicine specialist. Fitzgerald says the doulas don't just assist clients during childbirth. They help them navigate the complicated healthcare and legal systems.
Just having someone there who's walked in their shoes, who doesn't judge them, and provides just like non-stigmatizing support.
One of the biggest challenges is building trust with clients. Many have been treated poorly in medical settings, so the doulas have to work really hard to show them they're on their team. But it's a complicated issue. In 24 states, including Illinois, Iowa, and Indiana, substance use during pregnancy is considered child abuse. Both medical professionals and peer recovery doulas are mandated reporters. If a mother who uses substances hopes to keep her baby, she's got to go through an investigation with a child welfare agency and may need to appear in court, sometimes just days after giving birth. At a recent meetup in Chicago for doulas and others who provide services to pregnant people in recovery, Carly Ann Brown said she's seen mothers lose custody of their child and then start using substances again because they don't know how else to cope.
I literally had a patient tell me the only reason that I'm not using drugs is because of my baby. And like, if my baby goes to foster care, my fear of what might happen to my baby in foster care, I will use drugs, like, to deal with that.
And also,
child welfare agencies have a mandate to do what's in the child's best interest. But it isn't always clear what that means. Being born with a chemical dependency can be traumatic to a child, but so can being taken away from their mother. Losing a child can be traumatic for the mother, too. And Michelle Kavoris knows from experience what that's like. She says placing her child for adoption was hard enough, but the way she was treated in the hospital made it even more traumatic. Kavoris channels that into her work with her doula clients today. She teaches them something that took her a long time to realize, that they are worthy of fair and compassionate care.
And when they finally realize it, and then they can start advocating for themselves because they are deserving of it, it's pretty awesome to watch.
It's hard work, she says, but it's worth it. I'm Darian Benson, Side Effects Public Media.
Side Effects Public Media is a regional reporting collaboration focused on public health. We've got more to come on Statewide. Stay right here. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. An annual physical fitness assessment has become somewhat of a cornerstone of the military. Each service has their own take on the test, but the newest military branch is ditching that model. Eric Schmid reports on how the Space Force is switching to fitness trackers.
A handful of airmen gather in the middle of the six-lane track at Scott Air Force Base in Illinois on a calm summer morning. They're about to start their 1.5-mile run.
We start our time after the last person crossed the start line. All right.
Give us 30 seconds back there.
Yeah. If you want to stay back.
Just walk up here, kind of saunter.
Joking aside, the final results are serious. Each airman has to finish under a certain time based on their age to pass this portion of the Air Force's fitness test.
Give me a thumbs up whenever you guys are ready to go. Knock this out. Good, 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 in the back. All right, cool. And 3, 2, 1, begin.
The airmen quickly spread out as they circle the track. Earlier in the morning, they completed the other parts of the fitness test.
Push-uppers, ready up?
A minute of uninterrupted push-ups and later sit-ups.
Count out loud, guys.
Five.
This once-a-year assessment is how the Air Force measures if its airmen are physically ready for what their service requires. But the newly minted Space Force wants their fitness assessment to feel entirely different. Members of the Space Force won't have an annual test. Instead, they'll get a smart ring or other wearable fitness device that will keep track of their physical activity throughout the entire year. Chief Master Sergeant James Sabias is a senior enlisted leader for Space Force's Training and Readiness Command.
Our standards really haven't changed, right? We still are utilizing the Air Force PT standards. The difference is in our approach.
The Space Force has plans for a digital community for its troops, who are called Guardians, where they can see data from their own device and how it compares to others in the service. Patrick Hitchens is the CEO of Austin-based Fit Rankings, the company building that platform for the Space Force. He says it allows Guardians to count the activities they normally do, something that's not always the case now.
Maybe you're not good at running. Maybe you're not good
at pull-ups. So there is some amount of dimensionality to these tests that favors one activity over another.
Hitchens says his platform can convert any activity into a MET minute, a common measure of energy expenditure recognized by the CDC. Sabias says the Space Force hopes this approach will turn fitness into more of a carrot than stick.
Many times fitness is almost used as, you know, a kind of a go, no-go kind of thing, right? You either have it or you don't. I've known folks that can do all their PT aspects and run a really fast mile and a half, but yet their eating habits are poor. Their sleeping habits are poor. They're not healthy.
Space Force leadership hopes the data guardians get from their devices will help them take more ownership of their health. Research has found an annual test spurs some military members to engage in eating disorders and other unhealthy behavior. Lindsay Bodell is an assistant professor of psychology at Western University in Ontario. She says troops may worry about their careers if they fail a fitness test.
Having consequences of not meeting the standards then may lead to people to engage in pretty extreme behaviors.
But Bodell says switching to fitness monitors won't necessarily solve that problem. It may even make it worse. She says many researchers have found an association between eating disorder symptoms and fitness trackers.
Some of the negative consequences, I think, might be preoccupation with certain exercise regimes or fixation on numbers, which could end up getting in the way of other activities.
Bodell says there needs to be more research on this topic as it relates to the military. The Space Force plans to evaluate its fitness tracker program after a year to decide if it will become permanent. I'm Eric Schmid.
Farmers in the Midwest are gearing up for a fight over whether pipelines can cut through their land. Three companies are proposing piping carbon dioxide emissions from ethanol plants out of state. Many look to the experience other farmers had with the Dakota Access Pipeline a few years ago. For Harvest Public Media, Katie Pikus brings us that story.
Keith Puntany's home in Boone, Iowa, has become a library dedicated to his fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline.
There's tens of thousands of pages and stuff, you know, in here.
The retired tax attorney's living room has bookcases of legal documents and maps of his farmland. After the crude oil pipeline was announced in 2014, Puntany feared what would happen if the oil spilled.
If there's ever any kind of a release, the way that they were crossing people's property was going to damage a lot of, you know, the farmland.
He also worried about how construction would impact his soil and yields. The Iowa Utilities Board signed off on the project and allowed the pipeline's owner to seize people's private land. Puntany fought the board and the pipeline all the way to the Iowa Supreme Court, but he lost. It was a big disappointment.
We expected them actually to rule in our favor because there had never been an Iowa Supreme Court case on an interstate pipeline, you know, benefit out of Iowa giving eminent domain. That was the first time that had happened.
Eminent domain, that's the power to seize people's private property for a public purpose.
One of the first things you learn in law school and in your first year property class is that property rights are a lot less absolute than you probably assumed.
That's University of Iowa law professor Shannon Raisler. She says eminent domain has been used for projects such as water infrastructure and highways. Raisler says for eminent domain to be applied in Iowa, there has to be a public purpose beyond economic development.
The question for the carbon pipelines is, what is the extra benefit to Iowans from shipping carbon from ethanol and fertilizer plants out of state? Extra meaning more than just revenue from taxes and jobs.
The carbon pipeline companies say they will extend the viability of the ethanol industry, an important part of Iowa's economy. They also promise environmental benefits. Elizabeth Burns-Thompson is with Navigator CO2 Ventures, one of the pipeline companies.
These are truly taking CO2 that otherwise would have been emitted in some of our small communities across our state. This isn't just offsetting an emission, you know, on one coast to the other. This is truly preventing an emission that would have happened in some of our backyards.
But some Iowa farmers don't see it that way.
This is greenwashing on the benefits that they're trying to sell.
Richard McCain has more than 900 acres of farmland in northern Iowa. Some of the land has been in his family for more than a century. He and his wife, Phyllis, are familiar with how other farmers struggled with the Dakota Access Pipeline. They worry about the safety of the carbon dioxide pipelines and being forced to give up the land that they've worked hard to protect.
It's a nightmare. It's a living nightmare. Because, you know, it'll be right smack in front of our house. It's hazardous material.
It makes a person angry that this is private property and they think they can come in and do what they want to.
In Keith Puntany's case, 5 years after the Dakota Access Pipeline's construction, he's still seeing impacts. He says the 3 acres affected are less productive and their value is down. The pipeline's owner, Energy Transfer, says it's mostly done remediating the land and it's still working with a few farmers to fix things. But now Puntany's farmland could be adjacent to a carbon dioxide pipeline. He says it's deja vu.
I have concerns that this is just same thing, different day in terms of how this pipe is going to be put in the ground and that the issues that I experienced and still experience 5 years later are not ending. They're just going to happen to somebody else.
So Puntany is preparing for another fight, and he's not the only one. Farmers across the state are organizing, hoping to protect their land. I'm Katie Pikus.
2/3 of farmers said the pandemic affected their mental health. That's according to an American Farm Bureau poll. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has awarded grants to states across the country to help improve mental health outreach among farmers. And as Kendall Crawford reports, some Midwestern states are distributing the resources not only to farmers, but also to businesses and community members they interact with daily. And a warning for our listeners, this story mentions suicide.
The backyard of Doug Fuller's farmhouse in Cambridge, Iowa, is full of brightly colored flowers.
Okay, then I got impatience and more vinca, and then this is just a hodgepodge.
But this time last year, this same garden was bare, as Fuller was in the middle of a year-long battle with severe depression and suicidal thoughts.
Hopeless. Hopelessness, you know, is probably the biggest thing you think of because, you know, when this goes on for month after month after month, you know, you just feel like, is this ever going to improve?
He doesn't know what triggered it. Maybe it was the way a windstorm flattened some of his crops. Maybe it was the isolation of COVID. But he does know he only got better after he asked for help.
I just don't see any reason to have kept all this, you know, to myself, because it was as real as, you know, we are sitting here today.
This experience of farmers grappling with suicide is devastatingly common. Farmers and ranchers are nearly 2 times more likely to die by suicide in the U.S. compared to other occupations, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Many hesitate to tell someone.
They're reluctant to reveal what they perceive as weaknesses. When indeed admitting that we need help is a strength, not a weakness.
That's Michael Roseman, an agricultural behavioral specialist. He says farmers face a lot of factors out of their control, weather, commodity prices, global markets, and that can lead to a lot of stress. What makes a good farmer, independence, a willingness to take risks, can work against them when they need help. But farmers often trust those in the ag business.
They often show the signs of distress to people who they work with regularly. They will tell people who are perceived to be on their side about what they're going through.
That's why the Iowa Department of Agriculture is taking its mental health outreach beyond the farm, to banks, to veterinarian offices, to pesticide safety trainings. They're equipping people who interact with farmers on how to identify distress and refer them to resources. At the annual Farm Bureau Agency meeting in Ute, a small town in western Iowa, Donna Mills steps up to the microphone.
I just want to point out a few pages with some valuable resources.
She directs the crowd to the pamphlets sitting in front of them. They're packed full with suicide warning signs and hotline numbers. The outreach coordinator says sometimes this presentation is met with awkward laughter. Other times, she sees its impact.
There were a few sessions that I had where someone would come up after me and say, you know, there was a guy that was sitting in this training. He attempted to take his own life several times already. So thank you.
Similar programs are being embraced in Nebraska. In 2019, the Department of Agriculture began to offer two-hour workshops to help community members understand farm stress. The workshop's facilitator, Glennis McClure, says the goal is to teach participants how to talk to a producer in crisis and how to ask that really important, really difficult question. Are you thinking about suicide?
We really shouldn't be afraid of reaching out and trying to, you know, find out where people are in that scheme of things. It is something that we asked folks in the workshop to practice.
Back in Cambridge, Fuller says he's not sure where he'd be if no one asked him that question. Last year, he didn't always believe he'd make it to the next harvest. But he says it helped that his family and friends never stopped insisting he would. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Kendall Crawford.
If you or someone you know is struggling with suicidal thoughts, you can call the new hotline 988 for help. A national award-winning Chicago poet has made her home in Rockford, and although she performs spoken word across the country, she still makes time to saturate her community with the art form. Yvonne Booz brings us her story.
I speak spoken word while you cast spells.
Goddess Boria the Poet hosted her first poetry slam in Rockford last year. At that time, she says, she wanted to highlight the city, so she brought in poets from across the country.
So many people were coming to me, telling me how much it was needed and necessary and how refreshing it was and how much they wanted to see more of it. And so I decided to stay consistent.
Since then, she's done other things in Rockford. Most recently was the Youth Explosion Talent Showcase. Goddess Warrior the Poet says writing was something she did as a child. She started writing essays in third grade, but in middle school, she grappled with something personal.
I was writing to really get out what I was going through at that time. I was in the middle of my own identity, you know, struggling, learning who I was, dealing with a lot of peer pressure from school, my neighborhood at the time.
She says writing poetry became her form of therapy. As she matured, she developed the courage to transfer her words from the paper to the microphone. Her first spoken word performance allowed her to speak freely about the same thing that prompted her writing in middle school.
I realized that in order for me to be the best artist or the best poet, I had to be my truest self. And it wasn't until I was able to embrace who I really was and on stage so that I could truly be myself off stage too.
She says she did this nervously with her paper in her hand. About a year after transitioning into doing spoken word, she was persuaded to take things a step further, and her confidence exploded.
I got into my first poetry slam because people was telling me, oh, you got it, you should do slam, you should slam. And now I have awards for winning slams, but but yeah, I started out like that.
Slam poetry is a competition where a group of judges score each performance. There are usually a few rounds before the final winner is announced. Preparing for this experience helped her perform without reading. She started recording her verses and says this technique helped her memorize her pieces. Her first slam poem was called Chirac.
You see, this be Chirac, the city of no brotherly love, where you are lame if you don't drink alcohol or smoke drugs.
Goddess Warrior the Poet says there is one aspect of being a spoken word artist that she isn't that fond of, and that's negotiating pay. But she says her resume allows her to keep thriving.
When you talk about doing this for your purpose and walking in your purpose, that's solely what it's all about. But when you're doing it for the right things, those accolades and achievements, they just fall. They fall in your place, fall in place. It just comes out of nowhere the same way the pay does.
Goddess Warrior the Poet is a mother with four children, so she understands the work mothers must do. In May of 2021, she released a poetic short film called The Toughest Job. She wrote it for her mom, who she says was her biggest supporter when she was a child.
You know, that still stays with me to this day. And my mother is deceased. But I remember how much she enjoyed me doing what I loved and how much she pushed me. And so I use that today. You know, it's still my fuel.
Every other day she's ready to call it quits. But who else could she depend on to feed her kids? Never mind what daddy did.
Goddess Warrior the Poet continues to spread her gift by doing youth workshops and other events in the community. The second annual, the Gods and Goddesses Poetry Slam, is scheduled to take place October 8th. More information about this and other events involving Goddess Warrior the Poet can be found on her Facebook page. Goddess Warrior the Poet says there is power in writing, and she encourages everyone, especially young people, to write their thoughts down, because you never know when it could turn into a million-dollar idea.
What is it really going to take for the killers to stop?
I'm Yvonne Boone.
But how do we expect to see it when most of these kids have never been exposed to love?
We've got more to come on Statewide in just a moment. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll talk about challenges to books. But first, a group of Rock Island County residents continues to ask the county board to reconsider its decision to tear down the old courthouse. Michelle O'Neill brings us the details.
The group is called the Courthouse Revitalization Committee. Member Greg Swanson from Moline says he's filed Freedom of Information requests with the Rock Island County Board to find out more about what led to the board's decision to tear it down. In Illinois, sheriffs are responsible for taking care of courthouse repair and maintenance. In Rock Island County, that's Jerry Bustos, who has spoken to the board and Public Building Commission about the condition of the 125-year-old building. And Swanson says some of the sheriff's statements were inaccurate and misleading.
So the person that's in charge of it doesn't understand what it's made out of, and further has told the county on multiple occasions that it's concrete. Exterior concrete is heaving in many places and chunks break off and fall. And he repeated that it's at the key moment.
Swanson says based on his research and records obtained from Freedom of Information requests, he thinks a small group of county officials decided to demolish the courthouse long before the full board considered it.
And the board, rather than just listening to the people and then disregarding them, they need to engage and make a partnership, and we need to bring these partners back in, and we can find a viable solution.
Swanson says preservationists want the county to conduct an unbiased report about the value and structural integrity of the old courthouse.
I'm Michelle O'Neill.
It's now a crime in Missouri to provide students with visual depictions of genitals or sex acts. That means the same parents who filed book challenges last school year can now file criminal complaints about illustrated novels. Kate Grumke reports in at least one Missouri school district, law enforcement got involved long before the new law went into effect.
In response to the new law, librarians across Missouri have been going page by page through books. One librarian who wanted to remain anonymous sent a recording of the process to St. Louis Public Radio. You can hear them flipping through pages, looking for anything that could get them in legal trouble. But now St. Louis Public Radio has confirmed that well before the law was enacted, people had already been calling the police about books they thought were inappropriate. At least one police officer responded by visiting a librarian. The officer stationed at Wentzville's Liberty High School went to talk to the school's librarian about the books in her collection twice last school year. The officer is employed by both the Wentzville School District and the O'Fallon Police Department. An O'Fallon Watch commander says the visits were for the officer's own understanding of the books the parents complained about. And a school district spokesperson characterizes the visits as, quote, informal conversations between two coworkers. But the librarian remembers the situation differently. She didn't want to be named because she's afraid for her safety. She told St. Louis Public Radio that she agreed the discussions were casual, but added that it felt, quote, scary and surreal to have a police officer walk into her library because someone accused her of giving pornography to kids. This happened at a time when Wentzville's school board meetings had become very contentious, with parents showing up to denounce books.
I'm going to read out loud some sexually explicit content.
I don't know how many more books are like that. We're going to find out.
How can this be allowed?
It is criminal.
No further action was taken by the police department in response to the complaints, and no reports were filed. But a similar situation might go another way today because of Missouri's new law. If teachers, librarians, or other school officials are charged with giving a student a sexually explicit book, they could face up to a year in jail or a $2,000 fine. In the St. Louis area, at least seven school districts have removed almost 40 titles so far this year alone. The vast majority are illustrated novels. An internal document shows more than 200 books are being reviewed in the Wentzville School District because of the new law. Librarians worry this is a slippery slope.
We do stand for intellectual freedom. We do stand for the freedom to read.
Melissa Corey is president of the Missouri Association of School Librarians and says she and her colleagues go through a careful review process to make sure their books are age appropriate and represent diverse viewpoints.
Reading is the most important way to develop empathy for others. We have books being published by individuals that even 20 to 30 years ago would not have been published.
So far, the majority of the books districts pulled were written by or about LGBTQ people or people of color. But the advocates for the new law say it's not about that.
I don't care about sexual identity or sexual orientation. For me, that is not a factor.
That's Andy Wells, president of the Missouri chapter of No Left Turn in Education. The national group has a rating system for books it considers inappropriate. Wells pushed for the new law, but wants the Missouri legislature to go further than just visuals. He wants a law against written text he thinks is explicit.
This is the first, I hope, of more legislation that will get graphic information out of children's hands.
He's also been encouraging parents to go to the police about this. The O'Fallon Police Department says moving forward, these types of complaints will be handled by the school district. But in a statement, the St. Charles Prosecuting Attorney's Office seemed to suggest it would consider cases under this new law. The office's spokesperson said they will review a case's merits individually if law enforcement brings it to them. They said they wouldn't be establishing bright line rules around the issue. I'm Kate Grumke.
8 months into the year, there were nearly 700 book challenges in schools, universities, and public libraries. That's on track to top last year's then-record number, according to the American Library Association and PEN America. Illinois has seen its share of challenges, including in Chicago suburbs like Barrington, Wheaton, and Downers Grove. In Des Plaines, in September, two ultra-conservative groups ran a training session for potential school board members. Challenged books include Gender Queer, a memoir, and the fiction works Flamer and The Hate U Give, which features a girl facing systemic racism after her friend is murdered by police. Reporter Maureen McKinney interviewed the University of Illinois Associate Professor of Information Science, Emily Knox. She's editor of the Journal of Intellectual Freedom and author of books including Book Banning in 21st Century America.
We are on track to have many more challenges than 2021, which already had, I think it was a threefold increase over 2020. So I really see this as basically reactionary politics. It's a way of thinking about what matters in our society. What does it mean to be a good citizen? I think one of the most important things to think about with book challenges is that on the local level, people can really have an effect on their public institutions. It's very different from, say, talking about the federal level. You can go to your local public library board or school board and with open record, you know, open meeting laws to changes that have already happened. So as we move to a majority-minority country, we see more and more discussion about how to raise children to be prepared for the world that will exist when they are adults. There's been a lot of discussion about issues about gender identity, and so we see that a lot of the books that are being challenged are about gender identity. So I like to think about it as people are like, well, I haven't heard about this before. How did my kids know about it? Are they learning about it? And so then that's the challenge.
What's caused that?
I think it's impossible to look at this without thinking about the whole arc of our history in America. We are going through backlash politics right now with the election of Donald Trump, with the changes in who is an American. That is really what is behind a lot of these, right? It's really a reaction to the idea that, well, maybe gender isn't a binary, okay? What does it mean that one of our presidents was Black? Like, it's actually very kind of like foundational to think about how do we respond to these changes that we see all around us. And the way that some people respond is really by saying, well, people must have learned this somewhere. So they must have learned it in books or in school. And the reason why there's an increase right now is really due to social media. So there always have been groups of people who have challenged books, but of course, it's much easier to find those people now. So you can go to the Moms for Liberty in Illinois Facebook group and see what they are doing. And it's very easy to find.
A pair of extreme right groups, Awake Illinois and Moms for Liberty, have been conducting school board candidate training forums. And those groups call for the removal of books on what they call sex ed and gender identity, which seem to be codes for LGBTQ literature and what they perceive as critical race theory. What are your thoughts about that?
So my first thoughts are everybody has the right to organize for putting people on the board. So I think the main response to that is that if you support these books, you should also be conducting training sessions for people to get on the board and to be elected into office. I mean, I completely disagree with their characterization of these books. It is really important for kids to understand the world around them, to understand themselves. I understand that some of these books are difficult to read, that they may present ideas that you may not agree with, but reading the books does not necessarily mean that your kids will come away with not having your values. You can take the time to talk to the kids about the books. And if you really don't want your kid to read the book, then your kid doesn't have to read the book. You should not take that right away from other parents who do want their kids to read the book.
What is the danger for society, for democracy, when citizens push for censorship of certain books in libraries and advise school boards and library boards to censor?
So I think that the community should always have a voice in what is in their local public schools and libraries. That's not so much the problem. The problem is that there is no consideration for the expertise of the people who are picking out the books in the first place, or for people in the community who might have different values from yours. So that is much more of the issue, that it's a way of imposing your own values on other people. Libraries are places where there are ideas, books, materials for everyone. And that's what we train librarians to do, to make sure that all of the community is represented. The problem here is the idea that only one group says what is acceptable. What librarians are trained to do is to take many different ideas into account as they do their collection development policies, and think about the various needs of the community. And it's not just one group's ideas of what is appropriate or not appropriate. Things go through a process. A lot of people read reviews. There can be discussion about what to buy and not to buy. Really, the problem is that there's an imposition of one usually pretty small group deciding what is best for everyone else.
Are there cases when books should be banned or at least deemed by librarians and educators to need to be limited to certain age groups?
Different books are written for different audiences. So what is actually often happening in these challenges is that the book is written for a particular audience, but people say that that audience is not the right audience for the book, even if that is who was intended for the book. Person who wrote it said, this is who I'm writing this book for. So there are books that are appropriate or inappropriate, but really that's up to individual parents to decide what their kids should read or not read, not for one group of parents to say that I'm not going to only decide for my child, I'm also going to decide for your child.
That's University of Illinois Associate Professor of Information Science, Emily Knox. She talked with reporter Maureen McKinney about the sharp rise in book challenges. We're out of time for this week's show and hope you join us next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find all of our episodes at the website nprillinois.org. Just look for Statewide. And our weekly podcast can be found through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations. We'll be right back.